It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 6 o'clock, we're airing a one-hour documentary called Mandela, an Audio History, to celebrate the life of former South African President Nelson Mandela, who passed away earlier today. The special tells the story of the struggle against apartheid through rare sound recordings of Mandela himself, as well as those who fought with and against him.
Still to come on Central Time after 5:30, we'll take your calls, looking back on the life and influence of Nelson Mandela. First, we take a look at the rise of mass incarceration in the United States. We lock up more people per capita than any other country, and the last few decades have seen huge growth in the country's prison and jail systems.
Our next guest has charted that rise and the reasons behind it, and she speculates that the time could be ripe to bring what she calls this grand social experiment to an end.
We're joined now by Natasha Frost, co-author of The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. She's also associate dean and a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Northeastern University. Natasha, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the core idea of your book is this notion of the punishment imperative. What do you and your co-author mean by that?
Well, we wanted to, lots of people have been thinking a lot about mass incarceration as we've seen prison populations grow to and then exceed 2 million in the year 2002. And people have been thinking a lot about mass incarceration, studying mass incarceration, but we decided to frame it as a grand social experiment, not unlike the New Deal or the Great Society programs, that it was a set of ideas that came together that led to what has become mass incarceration. It may have been less coordinated than some of the other grand social experiments and less thought out, but has some of the same major characteristics of those.
That's what I wanted to bring up. This was a social experiment, but it wasn't necessarily planned that way or set out with the view of what the ultimate outcome was going to be, it seems like.
That is. That's exactly what we argue. But we argue some of the characteristics of the sort of growth of mass incarceration over time have, the growth has some of the same characteristics. So, for example, we argue that grand social experiments always take place around a pressing social problem. And in this case, it was crime at the time in the 1960s. There's generally a coalescence of political will and public enthusiasm for a new approach. There's public frustration with the problems that opens the door to new possibilities. And then there's an idea that sort of gains momentum over time as a widely accepted new way to address the problem. That momentum, we argue, is gained from the sense that something must be done about this new problem. Constituencies that would normally oppose each other come together, and the action that they take is the solution to the problem itself. So there's adoption generally of a new, largely unproven strategy for some high-priority social problem, and based on that, that solution is based on a reformulated understanding of that problem. So that's what we essentially argue are the characteristics of grand social experiments, and we argue that the growth in mass incarceration had all of those characteristics.
And the problem at hand was crime, but you write that the solutions lagged the actual increase in crime. Can you talk about the timing, please?
Yeah, the timing is just off. There's much debate about how much of an actual increase in crime there was over time, over that time. And we're talking about the late 1960s. But there certainly was, even if there wasn't actually a huge increase in the amount of crime at that time, there was an increase in the sense that crime was increasing and an increase in fear of crime. And so that kind of drove what we call the beginning of the punishment imperative. What ended up happening was we saw a whole series of policy initiatives over time spread across the 1970s and 1980s that were all part of a new approach to dealing with this perceived rising crime problem. Many of those resulted around changing sentencing structures that would mean that more and more people would end up in prison. And so it's the policy changes that led to mass incarceration. But what led to mass incarceration was this sort of feeling that something had to be done about crime.
And was it around this time that politicians started to proudly wear labels like tough on crime?
It was. I mean, we saw the start of the war on crime, followed the 1967 crime report. The war on crime has waged on ever since. It was in the 1980s that we began to see a war on drugs, and the war on drugs drove much of the prison population boom through the 1980s and 1990s. And in, you know, in the year 2000, in the late, early 1990s, we saw everybody coming out as tough on crime. People couldn't out-tough each other, and that included both Republicans and Democrats. And so the rhetoric sort of was revved up to match the policy initiatives that, that came along throughout that time from the 1970s through the 1980s and straight through the 1990s, with really no loss of momentum over that time.
And race has been at the center of this from the time you're talking about until now. At the outset, how much of a factor do you think race was in setting these policies and making the case for them?
Well, I think a scholar, Michael Tonnery, has always said it best, that people can deny that they planned the racial impacts of the policies that they enacted, but there is no way that you could have enacted such policies without recognizing the racial impacts that they would have. So, for example, the some of the most egregious are associated with the war on drugs, where anyone, if you had sat down and thought about it, would have been able to see what the distinction, for example, between sentences for cocaine, powder cocaine, and crack cocaine would have done to prison populations. And so you can, you know, one could argue that it wasn't about race. I think that's a very tough argument to make given what you should have and most certainly did know when you passed some of this legislation that resulted in the prison populations we see today.
So sending more people to prison, keeping there longer, a more punitive mindset, can you talk about the impact that had? How much did the prison population change from when this started in the late 60s until its peak in the early 2000s?
Well, the prison population across the country rose, if you count state and federal prisons, rose from around 200,000 people in the early 1970s to over 2 million in the 2000s. So it grew dramatically and quickly, and the momentum just kept building and building. And really, prison populations, as we argue in the book, they're really based on just two things: who goes to prison and how long they stay there. We call that the iron law of prison populations. And so the way you increase prison populations is by increasing either of those two things, who goes to prison and how long they're going to stay. We saw action on both sides of that equation. So we saw lots of policies that increased the number of people who would go to prison and many, many more policies that would increase how long they would stay there. The policies that affect who goes have a much quicker effect on prison populations than the policies that affect how long they stay.
A huge question here. What has been the social impact of this massive boom in prison populations?
This we actually don't have all the measures of the social impact yet. I think with like all grand social experiments, it's hard to even assess the impacts. But we do know what some of those impacts are. We've damaged millions of individuals over time, prospects for the future. We've had effects on families, individuals, communities. There's a growing body of evidence that suggests that the concentration of incarceration amongst populations that live in disadvantaged communities has further damaged those communities and potentially increased crime in those communities rather than decreased crime. So the effects are many, and they sort of run across the spectrum, and probably too many to talk about now, but we do know that there have been effects at all levels on individuals, on families, on communities, and on society at large.
We're talking with Natasha Frost, co-author of The Punishment Imperative, about mass incarceration in the United States. So far, we've talked about a rise in tough-on-crime policies, a booming prison population. Coming up, we'll talk about a possible change in the works. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that mass incarceration is a failed social experiment, or do you think we still need to have a lot of people behind bars in today's society? Is there an alternative you'd like to see replace it? You can call at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up the conversation now with Natasha Frost about the rise and fall of mass incarceration in the United States. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls in just a few moments. But Natasha, first, we're seeing a decline for the first time in a long time in prison populations. Are people starting to rethink the idea of putting more people in prison and keeping them there longer?
That's the central argument of our book, that we you know, may be seeing what is the beginning of the end of what we had called the punishment imperative. We argue that there's been a sort of coalescence of forces coming together around the country, and those forces have come together to suggest that there might be a window of opportunity for actually seeing substantial reductions in imprisonment rates. Those will be slow and over time, but we've already begun to see it. We've seen prison populations fall across the country for the most part in every year since 2010, and that follows 38 straight years of prison population increases. So we argue that, you know, we've seen 3 years of prison population declines in a row. We predict that we'll continue to see more prison population declines across the country over the next decade. And we argue that that's largely because there's been a sort of sea change in the way we think about incarceration. The fact that virtually everybody now calls it mass incarceration almost, you know, suggests in itself that everyone recognizes that it's a problem. Today, policymakers no longer only talk about ideas for increasing punishment. They talk about ideas for reducing prison populations. We've seen a decade-long drop in crime rates, particularly violent crime rates, such that, you know, in 2010 we saw the lowest violent crime rate we had in 40 years. So crime's no longer the same, doesn't pack the same punch as an issue. Other things have happened, too. The symbolic power of what it means to be a felon has changed. And some of the language has changed. We now talk about offenders being in reentry rather than being released from prison. And finally, and this is, I should emphasize, this is probably one of the most important pieces, there's now a substantial body of research that suggests that the main programs and strategies behind the Get Tough movement have been found wanting. So, for example, we've essentially concluded that prisons don't actually work very well. They don't even meet their own objectives, let alone any other broader objectives.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Paul with us in Milwaukee. Paul, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd just like to say, as a retired chaplain over 23 years, that I think the entire system is broken because of the weight of the growth that went on over the years. In one sense, you could say in the early 80s, when populations were a little bit smaller, I would say many of the prison programs could deal with individuals and their particular needs. But as you mentioned, the laws changed, sentences got longer, much harsher. I saw just the rise of the lack of hope with people.
Thanks a lot for the call, Paul. So Paul, a former prison chaplain, says less individual attention over time, and we've seen suggestions that prisons are effectively warehouses more than anything designed for humans.
I think he's absolutely right. There's just, with the sheer number of people in prison today, there's just no way to reach them with the level of programming that used to be possible prior to the 1970s. And so prison programming can only touch a small fraction of the population. And so most of the people who are sitting in prison are sort of wasting away in prison, not getting any sort of treatment or rehabilitative programs, which might lead to reductions of recidivism. And therefore, we should not be very surprised that the recidivism rates are so high, that so many people do come back to prison after post-release. They've had nothing in their lives has been improved by that prison stay.
I think you wrote that in the tough-on-crime policies, people scoffed at the notion of rehabilitation. They believed it to be completely ineffective. How has the thinking on that changed in recent years?
Well, I would argue that criminologists and people who study crime never really argued that rehabilitation didn't work. Rehabilitation programs have been demonstrated to work. There's a large body of literature that has grown out of that argument that nothing really works in terms of rehabilitation, that has shown that rehabilitation programs can work. The unfortunate thing is, referring back to that last caller's comment, is that with the number of people in prison, there's absolutely no way to reach them. The other thing is, and to be completely honest, as criminologists, we don't know an awful lot about which programs are going to work for which offenders under which circumstances. And so targeting rehabilitation programs has been an issue. But there's, you know, not many criminologists would argue that doing nothing is better than trying to provide rehabilitative programs if you're going to put someone in prison.
We'll go back to our callers now. We have Michael with us in Madison. Michael, hi.
Hi. Your guest mentioned that crime, homicide and violent crime is way down in the, over the past few decades. And I was just wondering, is there one obvious reason that people could point to for that is, well, we put all the violent criminals in jail and are keeping them there. Is there evidence that decline in crime is really not linked to lots more people being in jail?
That's a great question. There's actually lots of evidence to suggest that the incarceration rate is actually surprisingly disconnected from the crime rate and vice versa. So while the incarceration rate or the incapacitation effect can explain a small amount of the reduction in crime, other things actually explain the reductions in crime much more substantially than incarceration does. There's a great book out there about the crime drop, the great crime drop across the United States, and a second great book on the Great American Crime Decline by Frank Zimmering. And incarceration is really seen as one of the least important factors in the reduction of crime, especially violent crime, over time. Although there's no doubt that there is an incapacitation effect, it's just probably quite small.
Thanks for the question, Michael. We'll go now to Paul in Grays Lake, Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hi, thank you. Could the guest speak to the privatization of incarceration of prisons? It's something I've read about repeatedly, and the fact that per these articles, there are now private companies that have incentives to continue this and to actually increase prison populations. They make more money by increasing prison populations. Thank you.
Private prisons are actually likely to be one of the most difficult factors in the attempt to decrease prison populations going into the future, at least in some states. Not all states contract with private prisons, but in those states that contract with private prisons, they actually have contracts that specify that they have to fill the beds that they've contracted for. And so there's a built-in incentive to keep your populations big enough at least to fill the private prison beds. They're definitely an issue. There's a the problem that, you know, whenever you run prisons for profit, your cost-saving measures come into play for the private prison companies running those prisons. There's the incentive, like I said, to imprison more and more people, to keep the numbers high and to keep the profits high. So they represent a problem, although, states have backed away from private prisons in some instances, eliminating their contracts with private prison companies over substandard care and things like that. But it certainly is going to be one of the bigger issues, and the rise of private prisons is probably one of the most troubling aspects of prison population growth, that we would privatize that function in our society.
You closed your book with recommendations on what to do about this, what to change, starting with an idea called justice reinvestment. What is that and how would it work?
So justice reinvestment is a strategy that argues for taking the money that we currently invest in incarcerating millions of people and reinvesting that money in the communities from which these offenders come. And so supervising more and more people in the community, giving them the capacity of for supervising these individuals to the community. Because right now, when people go to prisons, those prisons are operated at the state level. The costs come from the state level. The counties sort of offset the cost over to the state. But the places where people are imprisoned are generally nowhere near the places where they came from. So prisons tend to be sited in rural communities, and all of the economic benefits of those prisons go to those rural or communities, certainly not the communities from where the people have come. And so justice reinvestment argues that we need to reorient and start to reinvest in our resources, our justice resources, in the communities from which these large numbers of offenders are coming.
I want to throw a question at you from a listener. We don't quite have time to take him on the air, but Ed in Lake Nabogamon is a police chief in northern Wisconsin. He says our jails and prisons have become part of our mental health system. That's part of the problem. How do you deal with that in untangling this issue of mass incarceration?
He's completely right. That is going to become a very difficult issue, because one of the things that, you know, doesn't take a genius to notice is that the rise of mass incarceration coincided with the decline of the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill, and no small number of those mentally ill ended up in prisons. Mental illness is pervasive in the prison system, and so any attempt to substantially decrease prison populations is going to mean addressing the needs of those mentally ill populations, many of whom would be doing much better outside of prisons. But without the resources in the communities to support those mentally ill populations, we are going to face major problems with that particular population, because the programs and places for them to go to seek services have all but evaporated over the same exact time that we've seen this growth in mass incarceration.
Natasha, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me.
That's Natasha Frost, co-author of The Punishment Imperative, The Rise and Failure of Mass Incarceration in America. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.